would be the talk. Thank you, raises some rather interesting issues. I hope this will be interesting. I'd like to thank my warm-up act, who's just appeared, for in fact basically giving my talk. I'm going to talk about a lot of things. Some history, so David's looked out well, so I'm fine. Some public policy, Beck isn't here. I'm going to take Lee's name in vain at several points, and I'm going to use a couple of economic analogies. I know nothing about these things, so there's a reasonable safe fiddle now left. So you may find, in fact, that my talk is a little bit too much hand-waving. If that's the case, I apologise, but what I'm going to try and do is start with some macro issues, look at some specifics, some specific examples of what we have done and what I have personally done and how that's worked in terms of making science more open. I'll step back a little bit from that and try and come up with some sort of practical suggestions about what we might do more widely, because what I'm doing was a little bit scary. And then I'm going to come back to something I hope you can't argue about, which is my personal experience. So I'm going to finish with a kind of personal view of where this is and what it means to me, rather than kind of a global action kind of perspective, which has been perhaps prevalent up until now. So I'm going to make up some numbers. I'm not going to pretend these are accurate numbers. Let us imagine that the global government non-military spending on research is around about $100 billion a year. Let us say that about 25% goes on paying research staff, so let's say $25 billion a year. And let us say that each of those is on a two-year contract, and that they could save approximately 1 month of the time they spend on their research if they knew something that someone else knew. But that was not publicly available, that was not published. Now, well, those numbers we can argue about, but that looks to me like we could probably save around $500 million to $1 billion a year in research by saving people's time from repeating stuff that is known not to work, from repeating stuff which is dodgy because someone hasn't described the experiment properly. And that's quite a lot of money. Let's take another example. We've talked about the problem or the crisis in funding quite frequently. So let's again say that, I don't know, there's about $100 billion spent worldwide on the salaries of academics. But that's probably not a reasonable number. No, salaries and overheads and all those kind of things as well. And I would guess that most academics spend on average 1 month, let's say that's 10% of their time. I can't do the maths and divide by 12. So we're talking about 10% of their time writing grants, which to a first approximation have a 0% success rate, order of magnitude. So again, that's, what, $10 billion a year to be saved if we were doing things more effectively. So we talked a lot, well, Eric talked quite a bit about economics and sort of the ideas marketplace. I think there's a real issue of real return on investment. And I don't mean economic outcomes from research. I mean, are we delivering value for money? There is a real sense of entitlement in the scientific community. I am entitled to spend money on stuff I like. You do not have entitlement. It is a privilege. And as part of that privilege, we should look very closely at whether we're providing good value for money. Because governments are looking at this very, very seriously. The research councils in the UK recently abandoned an exercise where they were going to try and judge grants as part of the review process as to what their economic return on investment was, and they abandoned that. The fact they even thought about trying to do that as part of the grant assessment process is an indication of how seriously we have to take this argument. We need to look at doing science more effectively and more efficiently, in my view, because the money's not likely to increase over the next 10 years, it's likely to decrease. So I think we can do better. I think that's actually been the theme that's come up several times. And I want to try and provide some small examples of how we're trying to do that. So this is my very simple model of how science works. It's a toy model. It's not meant to be realistic. But we go through processes. We
get ideas from reading stuff. We develop these ideas. We try and get them funded. We plan the details of what we're going to do. We record that. We process that. We analyze it. Tough stuff. Greg's been talking about. And then we publish, and then hopefully someone else reads that. The traditional sort of interaction and communication process in science all happens here. The published stuff gets read. And we go around circles. And again, as Michael said yesterday, this was the most efficient system that was available in the 18th century. Things have improved a bit with email, with phone calls, with air travel that makes international conferences possible. Things have improved, but it's basically still been about things being published and things being read. Even when you have a collaboration with someone else, you very often develop the ideas together. You probably work on the funding applications together, and I've seen this happen very many times. You then go off in completely different directions and you don't talk again until at some point you just say, oh, we ought to write that paper. I wonder what they've been doing. There's a lot of money going into this style of research. So what if we could actually make contact around these other parts of this diagram? You know, whether you take that seriously or not, can we actually communicate about our plans? Can we find the best advice on how to do something? Can we actually have other people looking at the record of our research and going through the process? Again, the type of thing Greg was talking about. And by doing that, I would submit we can make the communication of research more effective, and most of the inefficiencies are in communication. So I can do mashups. In fact, science is just a mashup, frankly. Yeah, we've talked the last week about all these tools, and I don't want to labor this point. We could use these tools to do better, and what I want to do is actually provide some real examples of how we can take Web2 generically tools, read-write web tools, communication standards, and make science more effective. One of the things that people don't necessarily really appreciate when it comes to Web 2.0 is that the idea of taking that content and reusing it makes an assumption about it being open, available, reusable, pushed from one place to another. Several of the people in this room have taken my blog posts and copied them verbatim and credited me, and that's exactly what the license says you're allowed to do. It's exactly what it's for. It's exactly what it's supposed to be about. If I locked that up and said that wasn't something you should be doing, and the whole thing falls apart. So the ability of Web2 to improve communications depends on openness. And there's a real question here as to whether this can apply to the practice of science. So what I want to do is step through a few examples from my experience that show that it can help, it can make a difference in small ways so far, but that we can improve on what we've done so far. So various people have stolen my punchline. Usually when I put this slide up, I say, this is my lab book, and there is a collective intake of breath, because that is such an alien concept, having a lab book on the web. Now, I want to make a point. This is not a copy of my lab book. I don't have a piece of paper or some other version that gets written up and then I transfer it. This isn't a version. This isn't some sort of embargoed thing. This is my lab book. It is available on the web. When I press the go button, it's there. Okay? Then you go to this link. You will find that I haven't actually done very much work in the lab recently. That's the trouble with being an academic. So here I can directly communicate results as they happen in real time. Is that useful? Okay, so I've mentioned this example a few times over the course of the week. It turns out there's very little information. Can you actually read that? Very little information available online about the solubility of organic compounds in organic solvents. There's actually relatively little information available about the solubility of compounds in water, as it happens, but there's more of that, much less about organic solvents. So this is a first order pass at whether there is any information on the net about solubility of bochlycine, particular compound, in THF, particular solvent. So search Iran. You can check that. You can go and check the Flickr image. I think that one's on Flickr, so you'll have an upload date. So it's date stamp, third party. I ran that search 9 o'clock last Thursday. sitting in a hotel room in Southampton, and basically there are no hits. There's nothing useful there. Now, bearing in mind that this is after the point where Google have actually incorporated Google Scholar searches into standard Google search. This means there are no papers in which the full text has the term solubility, botulinum, THF in the same paragraph anywhere in the world. So it's not a bad start. It's not perfect. I could go looking for databases. There's probably more information out there. Zero water thing, there was no information on that date. And that was a little disturbing because Jean-Claude Bradley and I had spent the day previously, the Wednesday, 3rd of September, in the lab, measuring, amongst other things, the solubility of botulinum in THF. There's his record of that experiment. You saw a little bit of the record of my record of the experiment on the first example I showed. Again, you can go there, you can find it, you can see it, you can see when it went up. It turns out that he put this up about 5 minutes before I did that Google search, desperately thinking, why didn't you get that search in before it gets indexed? You want to go back and see what we did? You can do that. You want to go back and see the pictures I took at each stage to show that there was a solid in the tube or there wasn't any solid in the tube, or the little details that can go back, and you can make a decision about whether you trust the way we did the experiment. We've never done this before. I don't know yet if we do the same thing again, whether we'll get the same answer. But there's some information up there now about it. And you can make a decision about whether you think that's reliable or not. You can follow that provenance trail to a certain extent. To the extent that we can, Harry Collins, again, gave a really succinct description of where we might not be able to do this earlier in the week, which I really want to follow up and think about in a lot more detail. So, punchline, 7:36 p.m. on the same day, I run the same Google search, and up the top there is Jean-Claude's lab book page. Interesting question as to why my notebook doesn't get indexed quite as rapidly, but I think that's just because he has a higher page rank, just one of those things. He got into this earlier than I did. And it actually got to do with the searchability of our notebook, which is a technical problem that we need to look at. You looked at this Thursday morning, there was no data on the web. You look at this Thursday afternoon, 24 hours after we did the experiment, that data is available in some form. And we can go and look now and see if anyone's actually been searching for it. That'll be an interesting question over the next couple of weeks, the next couple of months, the next couple of years. Talked a bit about collaboration. And so the fundamental order of collaboration is probably between a principal investigator and members of their group. This is my feed reader. It happens to be showing the feed of the lab notebook of a graduate student. In fact, the one graduate student I have at the moment who's still based in Southampton. I live this life where I live in Bath, and I work in Southampton at the Rutherford Appleton Lab, which is near Oxford. That is an equilateral triangle with 60 miles on a side. I get down to Southampton on a good week, one day a week. Now, is that enough to supervise a graduate student? Well, we can have that argument. I think that would depend a lot on people's different fields and different expectations. I would not a priori think that was acceptable. However, I follow the gory detail of everything she does. I can comment on it from a distance. I have commented on it from my hotel room here this week. I think I probably have closer contact with the work she does than many of my colleagues that are actually in offices 20 metres from their lab. And that's because this communication tool, it's just a feed reader, it's a blog with an RSS feed coming to feed reader. It's not complicated there. This is incredibly powerful in terms of the way it enables communication. Imagine this on a collaboration with four or five different people who don't necessarily speak the same language, who are not necessarily in the same place or even on the same continent. That ability to start seeing how people describe things, to be able to communicate about the details of what's going on. You're not going to want to do it all the time. You're not going to want to follow every line. I don't follow every single thing that you put down. But when there's a problem, to dive in and look into the detail, that makes a huge difference to the level of communication you can do. And this works for us, okay? So this is an example. Michael kind of stole my thunder, but so there's a message in why the same example keeps coming up as well. So this was a request I put out. I had to get a proposal in for beam time the following week, and we wanted to do these experiments. We thought they were interesting experiments, but we wanted to show that the experiment had some chance of working. we wanted to tell the differences between two different structural forms of the same protein. Would our experiment be able to tell the difference? That's an important question when you're proposing to use 20,000 pounds of beam time. You want to show the experiment's going to work. I'm not good at building molecular models. I knew there were people on friend feed who are much more experienced with this kind of thing, so I put out the question with details. You know, there's a few interesting things down here. I don't have any money, but I'm saying authorship is important. Yeah. Attribution, credit, same kind of things coming clear. Be clear about it up front. So there's a whole train of things here. You can go and look at the details if you want to. I put this tiny URL so you can actually get to it if you're in a bit more of a hurry than trying to type this thing in. This response came back 20 minutes after I put that in. 2 hours later, we had a discussion about what we were going to do. A week later, I had the structure that he gave me, so I've just posted, slapped it in the email he sent me with the stuff in here into my lab book. And again, the record's there. That's all timestamp, author stamp, you know, all these things. It would have been even better if Pavel had actually put the structure in himself, but you know, we're not quite set up to do that at the moment. This is to show that we have a structure. It's also to show, you know, as a structural biologist, we can make pretty pictures, which is also very important. It impresses people no end. I had to download the software again to make that picture. Do I have a record of the software version that I used to generate the picture? No. Again, you can look at the details of that. And then, so here is the thing that went into the proposal. This is on Google Docs. You can find it from the lab notebook page. There is a difference. It looks much better on a log-log plot. You don't have to take my word for that. Go and download the data and have a look for yourself. We actually put the log-log plot into the proposal, as it happens. But I just thought that was an interesting example. You can have a look at that and see. Decide whether you think it's worth spending £20,000 on doing that experiment or not. So we can do these things. I mean, we can communicate. We can put the data up. We can get a date stamp on these things. We can use a wide range of services, a lot of them third-party services. Keep a record of things, so we've got an interlinking network of dates, times, people, accounts. This can be done. But yet, this is the same example everyone keeps using. And the reason for that is we've tried to do this a couple of times, and the other times it hasn't really worked terribly well. Why doesn't it work? Because the community's not in place to support it. The right people to solve those type of problems were not available. People have to be willing and able and have the resources to do it. And so there's a community building issue in there. So at the moment, nothing. But we've now got some experimental data that shows that actually what happens when we do this experiment, it doesn't match what was predicted. And so we need to go back to him and talk about building better models and go around that loop of trying to figure out what's actually going on. And yeah, at the end of the day, he gets his name on the paper. There's no question about it. He's made a strong intellectual contribution. He also gets, not that it's perhaps a big issue at the moment, he's credited in my lab notebook for doing this. Again, that's up on the web, that's available, that information's there. It's also in friend feed. There's a trail of provenance of what he's contributed. Does he get credit for all the elements of that at the moment? No. But maybe in the future there'll be more of that will be of interest to people. There's another whole interesting story about the career he's trying to set up for himself as well, but a story for another time. I've also written papers online, completely in the open. We've written grant applications online, collaboratively got people in to help us. You know, these things can be done, and they do work, and they are better than doing it the old-fashioned way. They're certainly a lot better than sending around Word documents. So this can be done. So you would imagine, of course, that you know we are opening this door into this golden future. Greg also showed this, that my colleagues will be welcoming this with open arms, this new way of doing science, this more effective, more efficient way of doing science. Yeah, right. And they have fears. And so I promised that I wouldn't just be positive. And these are fears that we...
That's why I finished and you went second last.
These are fears we have to take seriously. You know, these are fears that may not be sustainable, they may not be correct, but some of them are, and there's certainly things that need to be taken seriously. The one that is probably fairly alien to this audience, but is absolutely at the core of molecular and cellular biology, is the fear of being scooped, the fear of someone taking your results, taking your data, and publishing the paper. And again, that comes back to this issue of, does the fact that I've put the data up with my name on it, with a timestamp on it, count for anything? Should the journals be accepting that paper if I'm not included as an author? Interesting questions. I actually have a result on my lab notebook where we reported a result prior to the publication of someone else publishing the same thing. They didn't steal the data. I don't want to say that at all. They were working on a similar thing. Lots of people working on similar things. And there's a really interesting question there. When we write the paper describing what we've done, I intend to put in a sentence saying, we were the first to report this. Will I get away with that? Will the editors get unhappy about it? Will the referees, which will probably include the people who wrote the paper that I'm trying to... These are really interesting questions, and there are no straightforward answers to these at the moment. The bottom line is, as we've said over and over again, it is papers that count when it comes to getting jobs, getting tenure, getting promotions. That diversity of those things that contribute is going to get wider, I believe, but until we have a culture of data citation, it's going to be pretty tough. A more realistic fear is one of whether you're going to be able to actually publish anything. You've disclosed it. It's in the public domain. It's been published. You can't publish it again. It might be a view, and is the view, of certain publishers. The answer to that is most publishers view putting stuff up on websites as the equivalent of reporting it in a conference. And as Timo, I can't remember if he said it in his talk or whether he said it at coffee, this is a real issue. This whole line is getting impossibly blurred. Is this a public setting? Am I talking to you in a private room? Or is this completely public? Would all the speakers be completely happy? I mean, these are the questions that they're often unspoken. They're often not talked about. I think people need to be explicit. So when I take video of a speaker, I will ask them beforehand. Because, it's a question of being polite. Will this actually contribute? I mean, there are lots and lots of potential fears. It's really difficult. It's a difficult area, and this is people who are putting their careers on the line to do or not do these things. It's a risk management process. And there are risks and there are benefits. I'll come back to some of the benefits at the end, but what I wanted to do is try and step back from the sort of radical openness, from the, we just blow everything wide open. So what's something practical? What's something we can sell? What's something we can actually get people to buy into? And this relates to the question of what papers are. And in a sense, Greg's already done this spiel. But I'm going to take it from a slightly different angle. And there's a question here. If we just publish everything, then what is the role of the published paper? There's been quite a lot of negativity about that. Why am I standing up here supporting peer review literature? This is bizarre. There's been a lot of negativity about papers as merely advertisements, merely for being counted. So let's ask the question, is it good for? What is peer review good for? What is the peer review literature good at? And let's strengthen that. Let's use it for what it's good for. And my feeling is that what it's good for is creating a particular set of statements and claims that has a static point. The trouble with Web 2 in general is it's versioned at best, but it ain't static. Published literature with a date, we have a DOI, we have these sticks in the stand that we can use as a historical view of what was the view at a particular point in time. And I think that's a good thing to focus around. So this is my sort of view, is that a paper is essentially about the claims it makes. And I would argue that we should get away from publishing data as papers. As term I've used before is pushing a data-sized peg into a paper-sized hole. So there should be some substantive claims made in a published paper that have some relation to a model or something. And that the full record of material that supports those claims should be available, should be date stamped, should be provenance. Well, that's interesting. So I've stolen Lee's quote. I didn't agree with almost everything Lee said in his talk, but I thought this was a good soundbite. And in fact, I must have obviously lost the thing that I stole from your talk and typed in, but I've obviously, again, I've had a failure with versioning here. But the idea that you don't publish the paper, you publish the paper with everything that backs it up. Yeah, this is just good science. If I can't trust that what you've given me is real, that there's something backing it up, that there's some sort of real record of what happened, how on earth is that science? Is it? All right, then we get into the whole argument about sciences, and I don't want to reopen that can of worms again. So this is a problem. This is a really technical problem. I mean, if we have this claim, and there's the data that backs it up, okay, now the librarian's going to kill me for this. We can put data somewhere. It's not a problem. Google are going to take data. You can put it up. It's available. And you can point at it from the paper. You may not be able to make it discoverable. There may be all sorts of other problems, but we can at least point to it from a paper. Data is not the problem. Interpretation, the stuff that goes into the paper that says what you think's going on, that's not really a problem either. I mean, the dead tree paper is not a bad way to capture that. There may be some structured vocabulary things you can do about making that machine readable. But again, the first order, the interpretation bit is actually, you know, that's what we've been writing papers for the last 300 years. The data analysis and the methodology that goes into that is the killer. I have been asking a number of people over the last 6 months to point me at a single paper where the data analysis is replicable. Same, again, question that Greg was asking. I have been pointed at and have not yet thoroughly looked into two examples, and only two. One from Sean Adie's group, where they make all the details of all the scripts of all the bioinformatics they do completely available, and they do it all themselves, so they have access to all of it. And the other was talking to Katie Borner earlier in the week, who said that they make all the details, the versioning of all these things available. So there's a real problem here with tools. And again, I mean, Greg's actually stolen most of my thunder here, so I'm not going to talk about the kind of tools. I think we know, roughly speaking, how to build these things. We need a set of tools that make it easy to capture all of these things, that make it easy for scientists to actually make a record of these things. I'll come back to how we make it unavoidable, but I'm slightly more positive than you. I think scientists will actually buy into this to a certain extent when they realize how much easier it makes their life. So one of the problems with semantic publishing, and the type of thing that Timo was talked about a little bit, you know, is this idea that what you tend to do is you write the paper into a template, and then you're going to right mouse click over things and say, oh, this means this, or this is a chemical structure. There's a spectra to do with this somewhere, and we're going to connect that up and drag it in when you're writing the paper, which to my mind is akin to asking where in this river all the water came from. You know, the horse has bolted at this point. This is work. Scientists do not do work. I have an ongoing argument with the people at the Institutional Repository at Southampton, where we have a mandate for putting our papers into the repository, which I don't do. Why don't I do it? Well, the last time I talked to them, they said, no, we've got the submission down to 10 minutes per paper. That's 10 minutes I don't have. But this is 10 minutes I don't have unless I see a benefit for it. So we need to capture this stuff at source. We need to build in the mechanisms that actually capture this automatically, which brings us back, actually, to the lab notebook. So this is work by Jeremy Frey's group at the University of Southampton, who really built, I should say, all the systems that we use for the most part. This is sort of a first step, an instrument that does the blogging. So the instrument pumps out the results, and then you connect it to what you did after the fact, that the human is not actually involved as far as possible in actually recording what happened. We capture all these things as they happen. You don't put in metadata when you're writing the paper. You capture context when you do the experiment. Those are two very different things. But if we capture it at the beginning, then we can actually use it. The scientists, we can go back and we can figure out what went wrong with that piece of equipment. We have sensors in the lab monitoring light levels, measuring humidity, measuring whether the door is open or not. How often are you going to look at that? Not very often. But if you've got some light-sensitive mice, which you were sure were supposed to be kept in the dark for 5 days, and something's gone wrong, you know, in current climate, you're not throwing those mice out. But equally, if you did just throw them out, and you don't know, I mean, maybe that's a valid data point. You can go back and check. It's a question of being able to go back and find the piece of information as far as possible. And again, you know, there are limits to what you can record. So this is what Harry was talking about when he talked about contingent tacit knowledge, things that could be made available if we recorded them properly. So that's interesting. So this is where I think the tools are at the moment in many ways. And this is sort of paraphrased. I did threaten to talk about software design. From a post that I wrote actually about Connotia, but it's been picked up by a lot of people. As an idea of the type of criteria you need to apply when you're building things for scientists to use. The first is absolutely critical. You cannot expect a scientist user to change their workflow to fit your tool. You must provide something that helps them do what they are already doing. This is why the lab notebook is such a powerful concept. It has to provide a compelling experience, something that will bring the user back the first time they use it. It's not good enough to say, oh, if you keep coming back and bring in all your friends, there'll be all this groovy network effect. They're not going to come back. We have the evidence for this over and over again. They don't. Third one is a tough one, but again, it comes back down to software design issues. People have a bad experience with something. They're not going to come back. And one of the failures of some of the online citation management things has been the inability to actually save things in an EndNote file. You know, people want that ability to make sure they've got it back on their disk. Of course, they're never going to need to use it because your software is 100% reliable. But they want that backup. You should have at least one killer feature, one thing that really jumps out when people use it again, without network effects. They have to come in and they have to get that feeling, wow, that would make my life easier. And if you want a Web 2.0 tool, if you want that notion of people getting network effects out of this, you have to have stuff there to start with. You have to already have people in there. Take information from the web. Take information from the published literature. Don't care where you get it from, but put something in there so people don't just see an empty shelf. And so again, Victor demonstrated Mendeley, which answers very many of these things. I wouldn't say it was perfect, but it delivers on a lot of these aspects in a very real way in terms of dealing with that. And if you go to the SlideShare thing, and you'll actually have to download the thing and then put the link there, or someone can put it up on the friend feed thing. It's the one with Connotia in the title. So again, to allude to Eric's talk, I think this is where we are at the moment with a lot of these tools. There are actually some wheels down here. But I don't think it's quite that bad, actually. And I think at the stage we're at, we do have these suitcases with little wheels in the bottom and the tag. But actually, I think we know how to build the telescopic handle. And I think we've got to do some work on where the center of gravity of the bag should be. But actually, the process of building these things is going to be really interesting. But it's relatively clear how to do it, or at least how to start going about doing it. And again, I'm perfectly happy to talk about this for hours on end. But we've got lunch to get to at some point. So that's all very well. We can build these tools. What about policy issues? I think we need a mixture of carrot and stick. That was a joke. And so this issue of the BBSRC data sharing policies has come up repeatedly. That you tell people that they will share data, and there's got to be a process of real sensitivity about how you go about changing this culture. I think this is going to change. The research councils in the UK are very serious about this, to the extent that they are talking about stopping people applying for grants if they don't live up to what they've said. And they're putting money into it. I think those two things are very important. But there's more than just policy. There's also the infrastructure, the infrastructure of policy. You know, we need to look at legal things as infrastructure. We need to look at policy as infrastructure, as the things that help people build this stuff. It's the things that go from having sand to having a good concrete foundation. Oops, I moved on. So I didn't want to do that. And we need to look at people as infrastructure. One of the things we haven't actually really focused on, Greg kind of mentioned it, was this fact that the people who build these tools are not treated as academics. And that's a real problem. And maybe we don't treat them as academics, but we have to treat them with respect. If we want people to treat us with respect, we need to treat the people who are building the infrastructure, the lawyers, the policy wonks, the funders, the publishers, and the people who build the tools we use. So I want to just throw in a few sound bites in terms of policy, and again, this is something we could debate endlessly, but I'm just going to sort of channel John Wilbanks. When we talk about data, there's just one point I just want to make every time I talk. Data is a fact of nature for the most part. It belongs in the public domain. We should not be talking about licensing data. That's a really important point. We need to get that sort of information, that sort of clarity about what can and cannot be licensed, and what should and should not be licensed into the... So,
I mean,
why do you cite someone's paper?
Why
do you use their work? There's no real legal requirement for you. There's no license making you. The point I was making is that we are getting very bogged down in this community about licenses, about copyright, about all these things. And actually, a lot of these legal mechanisms are very weak.
Right.
What you need is strong community norms. And the beautiful thing about community norms is that they can be flexible. They can be different in physics and biology.
Sure.
We try and create some licensing framework that's going to work for everyone. That means it's going to work for no one. But if you have strong community norms, and we do, we're a very normative organization. People don't necessarily live up to them.
Down.
The Constitution is in the heart of the judges. Whether the nation is in the heart of the judges is another question. But you'd have to ask the man in the Clapham Omnibus that. Someone got that. The other thing is this costs money. And again, this is borrowed from John Wilbanks via Anna Gold, and it's actually a quote from somewhere else. And it's my cute animal picture as well, obviously. That was your mistake. This costs money. And again, this is why I'm really happy with what the research councils in the UK are doing, because they are saying, we will ask questions if you don't put a request for funding to make this happen in your proposal. And that's very powerful. So I just want to touch briefly on motivation, policy. All these things are great, but again, there are a number of senior scientists, both in the US and in the UK, saying, this NIH mandate, they're not new. This data sharing policy, I'm too important for them to actually. People are saying that. And people will say that. You have to expect that. So what's actually going to motivate people? We talk a lot about altruistic motivations, about doing things better, about doing things more efficiently. But again, this is a borrowed idea from Rich Apodaca via someone else again. And it was originally applied to web services and web companies. Basically, any company on the web that does not provide the opportunity to satisfy at least one of the seven deadly sins will fail. And I think we do need to talk quite a lot about these other motivations, the things that drive behavior in scientists. Now, lust is not a really important one, I hope, in science anymore. Its close cousin, avarice, obviously is. I don't want to know. Pride. Why am I here? I'm here because I got an email saying, you want to talk at this conference. Then I looked at the other people on the conference and thought, I'm on that list. Wow, I'm coming. And it's a great place to visit. And it's been lovely and really nice as well. But, you know, there's strong motivations of pride, gluttony, these things can be used to drive behavior if you approach them the right way. So there's a wonderful story, and I'll probably get this slightly wrong, so if anyone knows better, then correct me. But there's a long history of institutional repositories in the United Kingdom and being set up for people in a university to provide their papers, their material into them. Yeah, this is the green route to open access. And they're basically empty. No one can be bothered putting anything into them. And there are technical, social, and other reasons for that. The Netherlands took a slightly different approach. Netherlands set up, they set one up for the whole country. Small enough country that this makes sense. They also had to do with copyright agreements with publishers. But they had the same problem. They were struggling to get anyone to put anything into them. And so one approach to this, the traditional approach, is to have people do outreach, go out and explain why this is important and why it's useful and all the things that are going to make life better. The Dutch took a different approach. They took one or two of the most high profile scientists in the Netherlands, they took them out, wined them and dined them, explained to them how important this was. I suspect they actually put people into their groups to make it possible or easy for them to transfer material into this repository. And then they renamed it the Cream of Science. 2 weeks later, they couldn't cope with the rate of submission. They were swamped with people saying, I'm an important scientist. Why isn't my science in there? They said, well, if you think your science is good enough to go here, then here is the way to put it in. And it works. And which is part of the argument as to why perhaps institutional repositories per se are not the way to go. But that's a whole other story. Don't necessarily always think about working on people's good motivations. You can sometimes get a lot more powerful behavioral changes by working on their weaknesses. Oops, I walked too far away? Yes. So I've gone from the very general and quantitatively probably totally incorrect through some examples, through some ideas about what we could do. I've not really talked about the specifics of how any of this works, but I promised you I'd talk about it from a personal perspective. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to do, but there is, to start with, a very real first mover advantage in this area, or early mover advantage. Greg mentioned the fact there's this huge potential to really build these tools, and there's money to be made in building these tools. And people could move into that area and do a lot of really exciting stuff, and I'd be really interested in working with those people and a lot of other people. Microsoft, Google, you know, people you might have heard of, are very interested in this space and funding these things in a big way. I am, by any measure, a fairly mediocre scientist. Compared to the people who've spoken here today, I have fewer papers, lower H factor, you know, whichever arbitrary and probably not very good measure of success you want, I'm not very high up on it. A year ago, I started blogging about this stuff, and then I've been to, I don't know, 5 international conferences in the last 6 months, something like that, last 6 weeks, whatever it was. And Chad says strange things like, you know, this is the most anticipated talk at the conference. I mean, I've been fascinated by the whole meeting, but the notion that I'm in any way an important person is a very strange one. But there's a real space for people to move into, carve out an area, do something different, do something radical, and we're not all going to succeed. But if you want to take the high-risk path that Eric talked about and see whether you can really make a big difference, this is a potential way of doing it. If you want to take the safer route, then I fully respect that kind of approach as well. I don't have any children. That makes things slightly easier. But my wife is also an academic, so that kind of makes it slightly harder as well. So that's another whole story. Before I got into this, and I'm not going to give you the whole story about how I got into it, but it's quite a funny story. I'm happy to talk about it over lunch. I was a very stressed person. I found myself getting really quite unpleasant, and I suspect that is an experience that many people who've been through the tenure track process will identify with. I heard one person in the UK who of American origin say that she didn't know of any marriages between two academics that had survived the tenure track process. I hope that's not entirely true. But but I think it's an indication that this is a pretty high stress, sometimes very unpleasant profession. And one of the reasons for that is that you spend all your time worrying about what you can tell people, what you're hiding. Is someone going to come back and say, you're lying, I don't trust you, I don't. Can I talk to this person about what we did last week, or can I not? But can I talk to that person? Do I trust them? Who are they connected to? What can I put on my poster? And I just find that really deeply unpleasant. And one of the great beauties of what we do is I don't care anymore. I can get a lot more stuff done, though doing voice conferences doesn't really help. And that's not a picture of me in my study, incidentally. But my blood pressure went down. It actually went down. It's gone back up again since, because I have to worry about getting all these things working again. But now, what are the things I worry about now? Well, I worry about the fact that experiment I talked about, where we've got some data which doesn't fit in the model that Pavel built for us, I haven't got that up on the lab notebook yet. Those are the things I worry about. I worry about the fact that I'm here talking about the fact that we're completely open, and there's stuff that I haven't managed to get up yet. Or that I haven't managed to implement the notebook in my group at Rutherford yet because of firewall issues. And so I'm not being as radically. Those are the things I worry about. I don't worry about whether I need to trust someone, who I can talk to, what I can think about, where I need to, these things. I'm a very lucky person. I'm not speaking for my organization, but I have a fairly unique job in the sense that a lot of what I am judged on in the organization I work for is enabling other scientists to do their science. So that gives me a very privileged position. It's been a position where actually the stuff we do should be made available for our users to use it. So I'm not saying, again, this is, it's a hard row to hoe if you're in a conventional university department trying to sell the fact that, oh, someone else stole my patents. But at the end of the day, and I don't want to sound evangelistic about this, but, I feel personally, my experience is that I am a better person for doing this, and that the kind of radical transparency that is actually going to be forced upon us by the web anyway is something we all better get used to, and that living your life in the open is a way of maybe, for some people, not for everybody, but maybe make it a little bit more healthy and a bit more happy. Thank you.
I'm sure there are some. Paul?
It was an extremely interesting talk, and one of the questions I have is on how long do these sites have to exist? I mean, I noticed on your experiment site those links, see the very fast Flickr. Is Flickr still going to be here 5 years from now, 10 years from now? This is one of the huge concerns that publishers have, is and historians, if we have all this stuff scattered on 20 different websites, how can we... How long do we have to have that stuff there before it becomes an issue long term?
So there's kind of two answers to that question. There's the technological question of can we aggregate, can we archive, and who curates that, who's responsible for that. And those are tough questions. Those are really tough technical and financial questions. One of the things I learned very early in talking to the curation community is that the hardest decisions you have to make in curation of any sort is what you're going to throw away and when. Those are not simple problems. Do I think Flickr is more or less stable than my university servers? Is Google going to be there longer, or is my university email? That's... In some cases, I think we can place more trust in the medium term, in the sort of 5 to 10 year, in things like Flickr and things like Google, than I can in those other aspects. The other aspect of this, which some of you may find shocking, is you've got to ask the question of how good the record in the paper notebooks is. So I haven't talked about the failure of the paper notebook in a sort of video and data age. That's another whole talk. So there's that problem with the fact that the data simply isn't recorded at all. It's a hard drive somewhere that then gets thrown away after 2 years anyway. But there's the other more serious issue, that the places where these lab notebooks are kept also have a curation problem. So the University of Southampton chemistry department, the lab notebooks are thrown out after 2 years, which does not comply with the BBSSC data sharing policy. Interestingly. So I think you've got, again, there are risks and benefits, but there are risks and benefits on both sides. We ought to be much more serious about properly curating the record of research, because at the end of the day, if you throw it away, it's lost. Again, that's a lot of taxpayers' money down the tube. And we have to judge what the best way to do that is. There's a real question as to whether we can keep the disk spinning over the next 20 years, or whether we just have to shut it down with environmental costs. So I don't have simple answers, but I personally, for my group and the way we do stuff, the things that we are doing, I feel are much safer and much more reliable than what we had before on paper.
I was just going to say, for some of us, it's not so easy to do this. I'm working in social science, and some of my work deals with children. Well, I have to promise that I have to keep all the raw data in block files and destroy it 2 years after publication.
I knew there was another point I wanted to make on the FEAR slide, and that was that there are various types of data which is totally inappropriate to make them available. I'm interested, I mean,
actually, this would be totally innocent, that's the problem.
Yeah. That's an answer, a question I don't really have an answer to. That's a question I'm interested in, because, I mean, there's a sort of counterposition, which is that if everyone's medical records were completely available, we'd have the best data set on adverse drug reactions that we possibly could, and that would be an immense medical resource and would save many lives. But, you know, the privacy, from what I understand of the legal perspective, privacy always trumps pretty much everything, at least in UK law. The proposal I have made is that the key to being described as open ought to rely on the fact that in embargoed data, and that the different types of data that is appropriate have very different types of embargo. So my type of data, molecules don't really have privacy issues for the most part. We can make that immediately available.
Ask them.
They don't talk back. So that can be made immediately available. If that molecule is a DNA molecule, it can have privacy issues. So it's a very grey area. But there are other types of data where you would say, you know, yes, we could make it available after all the participants are dead or after 20 years. And there are cases where you can't, where you have to say, well, no, that may have an impact on their descendants or their descendants' descendants. So my suggestion has been that you basically say the data will be made available at some point in the future, which is not on publication, which is not flexible, which is time-stamped, and that once you've done that, you're at least committing to make it available and keep it for that period of time until. It's not a complete answer.
Just as a follow-up to this, if you Google for Latanya Sweeney at Carnegie Mellon University, she has done some fascinating work on what privacy means if they can correlate large data sets, and what she's probably best known for is pulling up Colin Powell's medical records when he was still Secretary of State, because by the time you look for people who have served as officers in the United States Marine Corps and are living in that part of Georgetown, you're basically down to one person, even though none of the individual databases reveal the identity. And she's done a lot of work on how you can guarantee various forms of privacy. The other thing to Google for is the notion of a translucent database, where, in fact, you don't have access to individual items of data, but you can do useful things asking aggregate questions, averages, medians, and so forth, without getting at the individual records or having things exposed. And again, I'd make a plea that if this is what you want, go and knock on the door of your local computer science department and say, this is an interesting research area, you know, interdisciplinary impact of health, blah, 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 this funding is coming.
There was recently an article in PLOS Genetics where they basically showed that in most genetics databases, even though they're supposedly anonymized, you can figure out who people are for a few correlates. So this is a big social policy question in general terms, because those databases are not secure. And that's an ongoing problem. I think we have
a... Being social scientists as well, where we don't generate that much data, I've had the impression generally that researchers' willingness to share data is somewhat correlated with the amount of data they generate. And I remember you saying that you generate like a terabyte of data or something. And I was at a talk at the Euroscience conference where some astronomers said that the reason they were sharing that much data is, you know, because there was so much data that they couldn't almost handle it by themselves. So
there's an element of truth in there. I mean, I again, it's a controversial view, but I believe the problem with big data is essentially solved. It's a scale and engineering problem. It's not actually a big issue. The problem is those thousands of hard disks in the median labs, which are totally inaccessible, even to the people who took the data in the first place. That terabyte. So the context of this is that basically our blog-based notebook has around about 5,000 posts in it and about a terabyte of data. And that's basically the point in saying that is that, you know, this is the core of our record. That terabyte of data is nothing big. That's
100 bucks a thrice.
Yeah.
I mean,
but the point is that's actually what the average biochemistry student. So my running guess of the amount of data that the average biochemistry student generates in 1 year is about 300 gigabytes.
Would it be interesting for you to actually have statistics on how much data different samples generate?
Yeah, I think that would start to answer some of these questions. And you correlated that with
survey for us.
Yeah. But no, I think, and correlating that with views would be really, you know, having data on that. But so what we're doing is all at the small scale end. And so a terabyte is small scale, frankly.
So just for comparison, like when I did my experimental work, I think the amount of data I generated was about 2 megabytes. Because it all fits into an SPSS or AMOS file.
Yeah, but did you, so are you including the forms, the telephone calls, the, you know,
yeah,
so, I mean, so you want primary data. That should include, if you're doing phone interviews, an audio file off. If you start doing that, you start seeing it adds up very quickly. You do the type of thing that Brent's talking about, problems from A to B to C to D, and then what database were you looking at when you compared that? What's the file? It's not the final file. Yeah, that's an Excel file, probably. It's not very big. But it's all the stuff that leads to that creates that sort of trust trail, problems trail. And there's a lot, that adds up to a lot pretty quickly.
Yeah, so I'd say I had 2 megabytes of data and 5 kilos of paper-based servers.
Yeah, which probably comes to a couple of, you know, maybe a couple of gigabytes if you scan it.
I'm just curious about, again, I'm sure people's attitudes or first reactions will vary by field and so on, but I had been involved for a while in building, a sort of social science-related database. We could have had maybe not quite a million records, a kind of sizable thing for social science. And my plan had been to not make it immediately public and open, but to mine the heck out of it with me and some students and get some papers and be very happy, and then open up and be very pleased to put everything for free and let everyone search it. So that seemed to me like a reasonable thing. I mean, we were putting in all the person hours and sweat and tears. Why shouldn't we get our first crack at it? So my first reaction, I put it as a example, not as a challenge. My reaction was, yes, of course I want to share this as widely as I can after we've put in, you know, gotten something out of all the work. And that sounds to be different from the angle you come at. I'm just curious to hear about.
So it's different from the angle I come at, and which is why I come back to sort of the practical suggestion of whether you want to call the replicable paper or whatever it is, that, you know, once you make a claim in the public based on that data, and I think that's a tractable route towards making more stuff available. This is really, so the context I heard this come up in was, again, a scientist who is actually really one of the active practitioners of open data. Student generated a large data set, and various of us, and he described this as open notebook science, which is the term we use to describe this approach. And Jean-Claude and I said, well, okay, fine, where's the data? And he said, well, we're not putting the data up yet because the student needs the... And that's a perfectly valid argument. Mm-hmm. We don't live in a perfect society. You know, there are risks. There are benefits to making that data immediately available, and there are risks. Mm-hmm. And you have to decide what the appropriate risks and benefits for you,
yep,
in a particular project, in a particular circumstance, are. Does that meet some arbitrary certification standard we might set? Yes or no, we would have to look at the case. But there's a flip side of this, and it comes back to sort of scooping, particularly in molecular and cellular biology. The argument is always, if I made my data available,
and look, or we assume you're not getting any credit, which is wrong, but then someone can take it and write the paper because there are umpteen groups working in the same area. Now, whether or not you made that data available, there are still umpteen groups working in that area. Your chance of getting the paper is 1 over umpteen to a Fuller's first approximation.
Yeah.
So by not giving the student the opportunity to at least put their imprimatur on some element of the process, you are actually putting them at risk, potentially. Mm-hmm. So again, I mean, I think, and I actually get really angry at some people who put this argument in a certain way, that I need to protect the interest of the students. You're not protecting the interest of the students. You're protecting the probability that you are guessing that you are going to get the paper. You are putting the student at a very great risk of not getting the paper or not getting any credit at all, simply by being in this area in the first place. So, yeah, well, I'm not going to get started on that right. But I think there are, as I said, there are cases where it's simply inappropriate to make the data fully available. There are cases where it's not a perfect world and we'd like to see more available, but that's not going to be practical. And it is going to be field dependent, and there are different norms, and where there are norms, people treat them in any way. So I'm not going to beat anyone over the head for making data available in any format, any time. I think it's all good.
Any other questions?
Everyone's hungry.
In that case, I think it's lunchtime. So.